Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight familiar, your butt at the party.
And Jake Latondras.
I am bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, didn't say it.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur on this Turkey Eve, March the 14th. It may not be the same in Tennessee as Spence.
No. Our turkey season opens in 2 weeks, but you know, I'm a good oozer, and I'll be somewhere in Mississippi in the morning. You can bet that I'm alive when I wake up.
I saw where Rob Kroon was camping out somewhere waiting on it to open in the morning.
Good for him. I'm proud of him. Atta boy, Rob. Go get him. Casey, be proud of Rob.
You went to one of my favorite spots, though, last week. Let's talk about that a few minutes.
Okay, where's that?
I tell you what, let's hold off on that a second.
All right.
We have talked about it numerous times on this podcast, the love for duck hunting and the love for turkey hunting. And I've always told you that duck hunting's my wife. She's always at home waiting on me. But man, turkey hunting is a hot chick that I just cannot get over.
I could flesh that metaphor out a little bit more for you, but I'm somebody that I pray that my mama might listen to this podcast or something. I'll tell you what turkey hunting is. I told somebody the other day. It's so hard to compare duck hunting and turkey hunting. They're so different, but it is such the perfect anecdote for what you get sick of about duck hunting by the time it's over. Like, it's you and nobody else, or you and one person. It's no, you know, there's no 8, 10, 12 man parties. You know, it's not. Are we going to hunt your spot or my spot? And there's 25 other groups that know it. It's like, well, I got my spots and you got your spots. And yeah, we might meet back and talk about it later, you know, and drink a cup of coffee together. But I mean, it's just such a personal experience. It's so quiet. So it's just kind of therapeutic for everything that wears me out about duck season. Not that I don't like duck hunting, but you know, by the time it's over, it's like, all right, I need a break from that. And it's like the perfect break.
I've always said ducks do what ducks are going to do. That's my experience in duck hunting. Growing up hunting in mostly cypress breaks, ducks coming in, they're going to come in from shooting time until about 7:30 in the morning. You got that break period, you cook, have a good time, and then about 10 o'clock at 10 to 12, 9:30 to 12, it picks back up again. You start killing a lot of mallards. They're coming in to kind of loft, loaf around. But turkey hunting, there's so many. I've always looked at turkey hunting as a chess match. It is a battle against something with a pea-sized brain. But one little leaf fall off to the wrong side of the tree, and he may go the other way.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in this time of the year when you're fighting so many hens.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, it's definitely a, you know, when the deal gets done and you step on his head, I mean, you do get lucky, but more times than not, it's your own skill that killed him, and that's pretty satisfying, you know.
Because you're making a turkey do what he's not supposed to do. You're making a gobbler.
Yeah, that's right.
Come to a hen.
Walk upstream. That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah, you're making him. No doubt. No doubt. And I mean, I think that's why. That's one of the reasons I think it's like the perfect antidote for duck hunting. It's just such a change of pace. It's refreshing.
Well, you went to one of my favorite places last week. Let's talk about this, Ben, because a lot of people have seen those pictures and talking about them. Tell us about what happened last week, because it was so great to see you and your dad with the double.
Yeah, that was fun. I mean, we didn't kill them both in the same sitting. He killed his in the morning, and I killed mine in the afternoon, but they were 4 or 5 hours apart, but it was really fun. So I've been able to take my dad over the last few years. He killed a Merriam last year. It was a Jake. Came in with 4 strutters, and they tried to give him the slip, and I'm not going to say he picked the wrong bird out of the group, but he picked the one that didn't have any spurs and a little bit short beard. And when he picked him up, he said, "Don't you even think for a minute that I'm disappointed." He said, "That was incredible." But that was in Montana that was public land bird in Montana on some national forest ground. And so we did that together. And of course we've killed a whole bunch of Easterns together. And we've never killed a Rio together, although we've killed some Rio Eastern hybrids in Kansas together. But he killed a Rio down in Texas years ago when we first started turkey hunting. He got invited on a trip close to the King Ranch down that way. And so he'd killed one of those, but he'd never even been hunting for a bird in Florida. And so it was kind of fun, to take him. And that's kind of been my last couple of years. I've been trying to help him check it off one at a time. And I'd love for him to try to do it in a single season, but he doesn't have much interest in it. He doesn't like to travel that much. I mean, he'll travel a little bit, but he tried to bail on this trip to go see my sister a couple of weeks for a trip. And I just said, I cannot believe that you're going to bail out on this trip. And he said, "Well, I'm not going to see your sister until probably June. And I feel kind of bad." And, but he came and he had a great time, and it was a lot of fun. We had a great hunt. Both birds were great hunts. His hunt was really fun because it was, we roosted a bird the night before, and I mean, he was dead to rights on the limb. He was maybe 65 yards from us on the limb, and, he had changed trees in the dark, and so he was a little closer than we expected him to be when he first got to be gobble time. I mean, you probably could have shot him off the limb. He was that close. And he pitched down into a big orange grove about 150 yards. He kind of flew past us. And when he pitched down, I mean, he could have been shot in the air. He was 30 yards, flew past us and landed out there and gobbled. And after about an hour and a half, he made a big circuit around us and came in. That bird saw Dawson. He kind of was slipping in from behind us, and Dawson was in a weird spot and kind of boogered. And we messed with another bird for a little bit and ended up in the process of messing with that. The next bird realized that, looked back to where we had originally set up down this real long road. And there was a bird strutting down there, I mean, about 40 yards from where we first started. And so we started trucking back to him. And we cut off, he was maybe 253 yards, and we cut off about, I don't know, we cut it down to where it was maybe 100 yards to the bird and got set up on him and called a little bit. And he didn't want to do anything. And I said, let's ease on up. This is the middle of, 10 o'clock by that point. We kept easing up, and we moved another about 30 yards. And when I kind of popped up to see where he was, he had closed about 30 yards. And so we were 100 yards, and closed 30 and he closed 30. So now we're well inside 40 yards. And I tell everybody, hit the deck. And we're kind of behind this one big bush. And this bird struts down the road and he's inside 10 feet. And you can't see him. I mean, you can hear him taking a step. You can hear him spitting and drumming. He's doing the whole show. And I mean, Dad's coming unglued. I literally think this bird's going to walk right down the edge of this road and he's going to just kind of poke out his gun barrel and kind of bump him like a bayonet. And like right at the last little bit, maybe 9-10 foot away from us, the bird kind of changes direction and goes across the road so that he's nice parallel with Dad. We're sitting this road kind of left to right in front of us. He's coming kind of from our left, but, and Dad shot him at 7 yards. And so it was pretty good, but he had a ball. So it was a good trip.
In moments like that, I know mm-hmm. that you don't just look at the surface of the moment. If that's the best way to say it. You soak mm-hmm. it all in. You're like me. You take the whole moment in. Mm-hmm. You know, when these pictures are hung in your office one day, and your dad's, you know, it kind of gets me a little emotional thinking about my dad not being here. But just looking back on mm-hmm. these pictures, man, you'll remember every detail.
Yeah.
And just be some of the greatest moments that you were ever yeah. a part of.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely special. I mean, it's for sure. No doubt about it. It's special on a lot of levels, but it's, you know, one of the things, my dad did a lot of things for me growing up, still does a lot of things for me, but one of the things that I've always appreciated that he did the most was he tried really hard to show us how big the world was. He tried really hard to kind of broaden our horizons and help us experience things, whether it was scuba diving and deep sea fishing or whether it was, you know, traveling across the country or seeing major cities or just broadening our horizons in general. And he did that even all the way down to just hunting, you know, making sure that, you know, we went and chased a coon dog and went and, you know, knew how to squirrel hunt. And, you know, he'd get somebody that had a pack of rabbit dogs once in a while and take us rabbit hunting. Just kind of the, you know, he really believed and still believes that, you know, well-rounded people just are better than not well-rounded people. And so it's been really fun the last couple of years to broaden his horizons in the hunting world. You know, like we went in January, Dylan and I took our dads to Nebraska, did a goose hunt out there in Scott's Bluff on the North Platte River and then, you know, a turkey hunt like this. And so it's really special to be able to, it's not every day that you get the opportunity to take your mentor and show them something that they would probably have not ever seen otherwise, you know, cause that's the reality is, I mean, my dad's killed a zillion turkeys, got turkeys right out of his back door and loves to hunt them, but you know, he'll kill a couple each year and be done. He's not mad enough at him to go looking for one. But, the reality is if I had not taken him down there, he probably would never, you know, he'd never go kill a Florida turkey. It's just not something he doesn't sit around and think about his bucket list in that way, you know, like I do. And so it's been fun. It's been very special. And, you know, that's one of the cool things about turkeys is you can be very intentional with the turkey. You know, you can back up and go, okay, you know, like the next one's going to be my son's or the next one's going to be my buddy's or the next one's going to be my dad's. And then you can just kind of orient your effort to that. And for all the great things that waterfowl hunting has, duck hunting has, it doesn't have that quite that kind of intentionality about it. Cause you know, a big group of ducks flies in, everybody shoots at them. And so you think you shot this one, but you don't know for sure. You know, it's just such a different pace, that turkeys just allow for that kind of, for a different sort of atmosphere of intimacy and intentionality that, that you don't get from waterfowl hunting. So it's I'm very grateful. It's very it was a cool experience, and he had a ball. So so did I.
Well, like I said, those will be some of the greatest. You look back on it, man, some of the best memories ever. Woo.
But you're always asking about the story within the story. If you know my dad at all, anybody that's hunting with my dad knows that my dad's kind of a pocket knife fanatic, and he loves to whittle. And so we got his bird Friday morning, and it was my turn, and so he didn't even carry his gun. And that's normal for us. Somebody asked on some social media platform, you know, wonder how many times y'all doubled. And actually, it's only been about three or four times ever, because normally when we hunt together, and we hunt together a lot, only one of us will be the shooter. So if one bird comes in, you know, whichever one of us has a better shot or whatever, we'll kill it. But on our farm, if we have two or three or four, you know, if a group of gobblers come in, we never shoot two of them at the same time. It's just kind of been one of those rules that we've self-imposed. And really that rule just kind of comes from the fact that our whole farm will flood from the river. So like right now, our entire farm is underwater. Mississippi River's got it completely flooded. All the turkeys are pushed out. And so we'll go stretches of a whole year or sometimes 2 years where we've got a few turkeys, but not really enough to hunt. And then we'll have years where we're flush with them. And so in the years when we're flush with them, we try not to shoot them out too hard. And one of those rules that we kind of self-imposed a while ago was, you know, if multiple birds come in, we kill one and just be grateful for it. Go back the next day and you can shoot one out of the next group. If that group comes back in, fine. But we just don't, you know, get Western on them on our own farm. And not saying there's anything wrong with that, but it's just kind of been one of our rules. And so after we both killed a bird, we were sitting around having a cocktail around the fire, and we started talking about that, like, how many times have we done this? And best I could tell, I think we'd only done it four times where we both killed a bird in the same day and were together for both of them. And so that was pretty cool, you know, part of it. But the story that I was about to tell you about the pocket knife and the whittling was right before I killed my bird. I mean, right. It was just kind of a goofy the way it played out, but right before that, he was whittling one of these. They have these things that look like palm trees down there. They call them cabbage trees or cabbage bushes, and they've got these stickers off of them that are about 2 or 3 inches wide, and they're hard as a, I mean, they're just super hard, but they're almost like a long skinny piece of plywood because they're kind of flat. And he sat down without his gun, you know. So first thing, if he doesn't have his gun and he's hunting, he sits down and gets his pocket knife out and starts to whittling. And Rocky, he whittled for like 45 or 50 minutes. And those things are really loud. Like if you break them, I mean, they sound like a gunshot. And I'm sitting over there, and I mean, it's just stressing me out to no end. It was dead calm, quiet. And I'm calling every few minutes, and we're just kind of waiting on it to get afternoon, and just, you know, kind of just, you know, we're deer hunting these turkeys at this point because it's late afternoon. And he's just down there, just like, and he just keeps on, and then it gets worse, and then it's like he's taking deep cuts. So you know what it sounds like when you cut deep like this, like, and then it's like a. It hangs for just a minute, and then it just goes, you know, and then it hangs, and, you know, and I mean, it could not have been louder. He could not have possibly made any more noise on a table saw, and I had enough, and I leaned back, I looked at Dawson, I was like, I'm ready to kill him, and he was like, just tell him to stop, and I was like, I'm so mad at him right now, I can't just tell him to stop without sounding like a prick or something. And he was like, well, you better tell him. He's like, because we ain't going to kill no turkey with him, you know, whittling on, you know. He said, sounds like a damn machine shop down there. I sat there for a minute, took a deep breath, and finally I said, hey, Dad. And he said, yeah. And he can't hardly hear. I mean, he can hear, but he can hear good, but he talks loud, and you know, he's whatever. And he said, yeah. And I said, you know, he said, what is it? And I said, that thing you're whittling on is really annoying to me. And he just died laughing. He was like, well, dang. He was like, is it always annoying or is it just annoying right now? And I was like, well, mostly just right now. And he was like, okay. He's like, I'm kind of getting my feelings hurt right there. He said, I've only whittled like 5 bazillion sticks around you before. I said, you know, it's not normally dead calm, and they're not usually quite as loud as those cabbage limbs are. And he's like, well, fine. He said, he's kind of pouting. He said, all right, well, I'll stop. I was working on him. Every time he whittles, he works on something. He got the project behind it. He said, I'll just wait until tonight. I'll wait till we get around the campfire. I'll put my pocket knife away. He didn't no sooner close the blade on that pocket knife than a gobbler walked out into the little field we were sitting on. And so the guy we're hunting with goes, oh, there's a gobbler, gobbler's in the field. And first thing out of my dad's mouth, oh crap, I hadn't put my face mask on. He goes, where is he? I mean, at that point, you know, the bird's like 80 or 100 yards away. And I said, just sit still, Dad. Just do not move for your face mask, you know. So the bird comes all the way in. He beats up the decoy. And we had a little strutter decoy out. And he jumps on it, flogs it, and beats it up. And I mean, he's at 15 yards. And I shot him. And Dad goes, well, I'll be dang. I don't think I've ever seen one die and not had gloves or a face mask on. He said, there's a first time for everything. I looked at Dawson. I said, man, it's like taking trip hunting.
but that sounds like a typical doctor hunting, though. Whittling on a piece of wood. While you're turkeying. That, I mean, it sounds like a typical what a, you know, he's got something in mind. He's going to whittle away at.
He's an immaculate carver. I mean, he finds these trees that have vines growing up them where they're, you know, they're kind of spiraled look to them from the vine, or he'll find one that's got a crook in it, like a shepherd's staff, and he'll start whittling, and before long it'll be a elephant's head, or it'll be a, I remember one morning in the duck woods, he carved on one of them, and it was like a pointer on the top of it. It was a walking stick with a crook in it, and it had this little funky knob on it. And he for whatever reason, he decided that funky knob on top looked like an English setter pointing a covey of quail, and he carved it out. Oh my gosh, you got done, and it was like, holy cow, there's a dang English setter pointed on top of that. Top that walking stick. But anyway.
Hey, let me ask you this before we get back into the story. Do you remember growing up with your dad? Some of the things that, you know, he did, his parenting just the way he did life annoyed you. But now you do them.
Yeah, I don't know if they annoyed me. There wasn't much about my dad that was annoying to me. Cause, I mean, he was kind of a larger life hero sort of thing.
Yourself now.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I. You know, you don't ever think that you. You know, you don't ever feel like you've lived up to your heroes, right? I mean, you always feel like you lacking something, I guess. But I know, at least in the turkey woods, you know, he was always a Nazi about how you walked and how you picked your feet up, put them down. And I mean, he used to say when we were little kids that we would squirrel hunt in September, so we'd learn how to walk in the woods quiet, you know. And he's still pretty good at that, but it drives me crazy to hunt with people that don't know how to walk in the woods quietly, you know, drag their feet, and step on every stick, and can't step over stuff. And
there's always that one guy. One guy that you take hunting with you, man, he finds every stick in the woods to step on.
Yeah.
And you got a turkey 100 or 200 yards away, and he's popping away on sticks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Everybody that's listening to this has that one friend.
Yeah, for sure.
And you want to kill him.
Yep.
All right, well, Spence, when we left last week on the Thunder Rolls story, we finished up talking about the assembly line, the first assembly line.
Yeah.
Right out of the house, which I thought was, that was awesome. Just yeah. I would be at my house.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. The first assembly line was pretty primitive, and we had a lot of labor in it, but it was pretty fun. We made a lot of calls that way, and those little tubes that we put them in were I think when I look back on that, the thing that just stands out to me is that nobody in my family did anything in the outdoors industry or even did anything that was product related. You know, my dad's a veterinarian and my uncle's doctor. And I mean, like nobody in my family did anything that was product centric. Like, so I didn't have a clue. I didn't know that. I mean, as dumb as this sounds, I didn't think to go to the store and look and see what all the other duck calls were hanging in. Didn't even occur to me that, you know, that we could buy these clamshells, that they were being stocked in giant boxes at some warehouse. And so we tried so hard with those little tubes because we wanted them to, we were trying to do our own thing. You know, we were trying to be our own deal and make, you know, kind of our packaging unique. And we wasted so much time and effort cutting those little things out and gluing them together. But it, you know, it we learned a lot from it. And eventually, I guess we got some clamshells, and clamshells just really revolutionized things. It didn't take us long. I realized that that you could stack the clamshells in such a way they actually made boxes that fit the clamshells, like, so that you could package stuff without a bunch of, you know, craft paper and stuff. But back in the early days, you know, those first couple accounts that we had were good, but most of our business was on the website, and we had a pretty primitive website that was like a shopping cart engine. And the big struggle was just getting people their stuff shipped. And so you'd get an order, and, you know, people would want their order like the next day, and online shopping was not as big of a deal 10 years ago as it is now. And it took so much labor to make and package the calls that, you know, for a long time I had on my website, I had a whole write-up on there that said, you know, if you order one of these calls, please be aware it might take up to 2 weeks to get it to you. Cause, you know, I mean, we were doing this kind of stuff late in the afternoon, evening time around dinner. And, you know, if we had something that night or something next night, some family stuff, it could be 3 or 4 or 5 days before we got a chance to like buckle down and get orders out. And by the time you boxed them up and wrote the postage on there, and then went and stood in the line at the post office, and like our biggest hurdle was kind of silly customer service stuff. And so, you know, that was really a headache that we didn't have any idea how much it meant to people to get their stuff in a timely fashion. We didn't do a whole lot of online shopping. And I think that's one of the things here in the last couple of years of the life of Rolling Thunder that's helped so much is we got a couple guys in the shop now who pretty well turn everything around. You know, next day, 2 days, stuff like that. You know, unless it's a weird order or something's out of stock. And it's amazing how much people appreciate that. And I know that's a small thing. You know, it's not earth shattering, but, when you're trying to invent everything from scratch, you know, recreate the wheel, and you don't have somebody telling you how you ought to do it or what the customer's expectations are, man, you learn all that stuff the hard way. You learn it because, you know, somebody would order a call 2 days before duck season started and then call you and fuss at you on your way to duck camp for opening weekend because they didn't have their duck calling. I mean, you know, my thought was, you know, what in the world are you doing ordering a brand new duck call 2 nights before duck season and then expected me to. But, I mean, for 4 or 5 years, every year, you know, I'd end up meeting somebody before, you know, 2 days before duck season or day before duck season, or I'd meet them before Christmas or, you know, people just last-minute shopping online. And it, I'm kind of getting off on a tangent now, but you just, I don't know, you know, you treat people kindly and try to learn from every experience. And I guess that was the biggest thing that, that I took away back then was that, number one, people don't really plan ahead. And so you gotta be prepared as the manufacturer to get them the product when they want it. Cause if you get it to them when they don't want it, then they wish they'd never ordered it. But if you've got it available and you can get it to them quickly when they want it and while their attention is on it, then that cuts you a lot more slack as to whether they like it or not, or whether, you know, they're happy with it, or whether they're going to tell a friend. And I mean, as simple as all that sounds, it, you know, a lot of that stuff, you just had to kind of learn the hard way of, you just get, you know, somebody gripe at you for, you know, man, you know, I ordered this thing, when am I going to get it?
In the back of everybody's mind, they think that everybody they order from online has this huge shipping facility like Midway USA or Primo's.
Right, right.
And most of your small companies,
that's true.
It's not that way.
That's true. That's true. And I mean, that combined with, you know, there's a lot of details that go into it. I mean, one of them for us, and again, this is going to sound really silly, but in the first 2 years that we were in business, I lived in Millington out at my parents' house, and the Millington post office closed at, like, I want to say either 3:30 or 4:00. Well, you know, if you didn't have stuff ready to go, you weren't going to get it shipped. And sometimes if you miss one day, you know, if you ship it on a Wednesday, it gets there on a Friday. But if you ship it there on a Thursday, it might not get there till Monday. People count those days up and they're like, dang, you know, an extra 5 days of shipping kind of frustrates people. And so they don't take into consideration the fact that to ship something, I guess we could have printed labels like we do now, but back then to ship something, you had to have it all boxed up and ready to go. And then when you got to the post office, you had to stand in line, and man, you get dirty looks from everybody else in the line at the post office if you got three tubs full of orders that need to go out, and every one of them, they got to key them in and put the label on them. And I mean, so there, you know, there's definitely a lot that goes into, you know, developing a little company like that. And people don't think about that when they order stuff online. That's your point. And it's true. I mean, there's a lot of hands involved and a lot of effort it takes to get that product to your door. And you know, just the easiest way to solve that is just to have a whole bunch of inventory. That's what people say. You know, you should build a bunch of them. You should have a whole bunch of them on the shelf and then let somebody go through and just pick your orders. Well, that's easier said than done because inventory costs a lot of money. We tried to build our business such that we could buy the smallest amount of stuff that we needed at a time, kind of almost like the Dell model, you know, just-in-time inventory. So we'd have the parts, and then we'd tune them and assemble them as we sold them. And we'd try to get out ahead of it, but the reality is that it took us so long to make stuff that we were never able for the first couple of years to get out ahead of the demand. And then, you know, duck season would kind of wind down and we'd get into turkey season, and we sold turkey calls that very first year. I made a pot call and I made our box call, and so we we would ship those and, you know, gluing those up and tuning those and getting all that out the door was just kind of a nightmare. And so once we get to the end of turkey season, it, you know, like you take your breath, you need kind of get your feet back underneath you. But then what we found real quickly was that if you were going to do duck calls for stores, like if big box stores was kind of how you were going to build your business, a retail dealer base, all of those places, they really wanted to take delivery of the product right around, you know, either the middle of July or maybe between July 15th and August 15th, because a lot of them did shows and sales around the first weekend in August and kind of trying to gear up for the fall. Well, you'd catch your breath for just a minute on web orders, and then all of a sudden you'd have these big store orders that would come in and you'd have to package and fill those. And so we had to, in order to ever get ahead of inventory, we had to kind of reinvent how we built the calls in order to spend less time trying to tune every one. And it's not that you're trying to make them cookie cutter, but what we were trying to accomplish was a common client experience. You know, we wanted you to be able to say to your friend, I love this duck call, and your friend order it, and your friend get one that sounds exactly the same, and not have the variation of how my lungs were feeling that day when I'm tuning that call. And
the McDonald's effect. Quarter pounder's the same every McDonald's you go to.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds simple, and it sounds like, well, duh, of course you'd want that. But I mean, when you stand there and tune calls over and over and over every day, you know, some days you feel a little better than others, and so you blow a little harder. Some days you feel a little under the weather and you blow a little easier. And just some days you tune calls in a room that has good acoustics and you can hear them, and some days you don't. And you just, you know, there's just things change over time, you know. And then on top of that, you know, one of the things that I didn't even realize, but you sit there and tune, you know, 20, 40, 50 calls a day, or a bunch of them in a week's period of time, and you're blowing calls, you know, for a couple hours every day. Boy, you change. Your lungs change, and how well you can blow a call changes. I mean, heck, just look at Drake Levy. He just won back-to-back cutdown contest. You know why that is? It's because he's standing back there in that room at R&T, and he's tuning Mondos every day. I mean, he's got dang lungs of steel, and you just learn. I mean, it's not any different than Steph Curry shooting three-pointers. You know, Steph Curry didn't always shoot this high percentage from a three-point line. You know, he's gotten better over time, and you know what I'm saying? Like, it's a muscle, you know, and it's muscle control. Blowing a duck call is all about muscle control in your air and your lungs, your diaphragm, all that stuff. And so you do it a whole bunch, you get better, which your customer doesn't get better necessarily. You know, you're still selling to a customer who really doesn't. A lot of them at that time, because cutdowns were not a huge thing, a lot of them, it was a novelty item, and they didn't really know how to blow them. And so if you're making your calls harder and harder to blow without meaning to, because you're able to blow harder, then it's almost like you're, without meaning to, you're working against yourself, you know. And so there was a learning curve to that, of kind of trying to figure out how do people want these to sound, not just what do I sound, you know, what sounds good to me, to my ear. And all that just...
Look, but before you tell how you fix that problem, which we will get into next week. How about that?
Okay.
I want to ask you this. I want to ask you this before we leave the story. The demand. Man, you had a nucleus of demand that wanted that call bad in the beginning. So once that nucleus was filled of people that, you know, that had that call, you know, and I guess we can get into that next week. How do you start branching out? How do you start, because how do you start reaching new people? To get them to start blowing a cut down. These people that have been blowing single reeds and some double reeds all their life.
Yeah, I mean, that was a, I, had to be, you know, a challenge. That was something. It was a challenge, but it wasn't. I can't sit here and tell you that, you know, that I created, that I made all those, that all those sales were cold, you know, in the sense that people walk up to buy something from you and they have no idea what a cut down is, no inclination of it. A lot of the success that we've experienced selling duck calls has been because the appetite was there in the market. And so there was chatter and murmurings going around and enough that people stayed curious about something. And so it was a matter of putting a decent product in front of something, an interest that was just already there amongst the consumer, if that makes sense. So, you know, the appetite was being built in those days by the web forums. You had the Refuge Forum, the whole network of Refuge Forums. They were huge. And they reached into all corners of the country and had regional flyaway pages. And what I found on those web forums was there were a lot of vocal people on there, but there were 10 times more people that never chimed in, never commented, never participated in any discussions, but they read every bit of that. And so that drove a tremendous amount of interest in the whole cut down buzz. So we kind of had a running joke. It was not really a joke at all. It was dead serious, but I could be sitting on the couch at night, you know, watching TV or just whatever, hanging out with Lindy, and I would start getting orders come in on my phone, like emails saying bloop order, bloop, bloop, bloop. And I'd go, maybe I hadn't gotten an order in a day or 2 days, you know, and all of a sudden I'd get 10 orders or 12 orders or something all at one time. And for about the first 4 or 5 years that we did this, every time that happened, it would be because somebody had stirred up some kind of a pissing contest on one of the forums. And it was a, you know, Black Ops is better than Rolling Thunder, or Kirk McCullough, blah, 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 is better than a Rolling Thunder, or, you know, we hate Rolling Thunder, or, you know, we hate Black Ops, or we hate Kirk McCullough. It just some kind of a, you know, drama, strife, you know, get stirred up. And what I found real quick was that when that would happen, it would either be the Refuge Forum, or be Arkansas Duck Talk, or be ArkansasHunting.net, or maybe Duck South. But y'all kind of kept a pretty tight ship over there at MS Ducks, and there wasn't a lot of back and forth. But in the whole cut down and Arkansas stuff, there was a lot of, it was a big drama filled. We hate this person, we hate this group, you know, a lot of hate back and forth. And every time that would happen, what people would read it, and then I could go through and I could see, and people would start ordering. And they just order one of both brands. So there'd be this big debate about, is brand A better than brand B? Well, geez, man, we both win, you know? We both would sell a call. And I've often said since then that, like, all these tiller conversations and duck boat racing and what's better, a Havoc or an Edge or whatever, man, I mean, I'm glad that I don't live through that kind of drama, because those were all drama filled days there early on. But dang, it was awful good for sales, you know, because I didn't have to do a lot to push a product, because there was so much chatter and conversation about it that, you know, any publicity is good publicity at that point. And then people get a product in their hands and they're like, well, dang, you know, this is pretty good. And you know, you don't convert all of them, but, you know, you sell 50 calls and 20 or 25 of those people will love you, and a few of them will hate you, and a few of them don't really care, you know? And so it's just a numbers game. And over time, you know, you kind of build up your following and people relate to you. And so it just kind of, the appetite for the whole cut down thing, just it really more led us than we led it. We didn't, I can't sit here and tell you that after the first little flurry of orders that I somehow drove the interest level in cut downs, because I really didn't. I mean, it really just kind of did itself, and I just kind of hung on for the ride, and tried to keep putting new products out there. And that's probably, it's a transitional point in our conversation, but that's probably the hardest thing. But the thing that was the most rewarding for us is we tried really hard to stay, not one step ahead, but we tried to just keep ourselves relevant by coming out with new products. And that's so hard because, I mean, still probably my favorite call in our whole lineup's the very first one we made. It's the original cut, but it's hard to make something new and then to sit there and honestly tell somebody, well, I thought this was better than the one I told you last year was the best call on the market, you know? And I mean, so that's a challenge for sure, but trying to stay relevant that way with new products and appeal to new groups of people.
I'm just saying reaching outside the nucleus of the Mississippi, Arkansas, Louisiana Delta, man.
Yeah. I guess what I'm saying is that
story some of these people have never, man, you take some Midwest guys, they probably never even heard of a cut down call that are blowing cut downs now.
Yeah. A lot of them though, you know, were reading this stuff online. They really were. They may not have been chiming in. So what I'm saying is like, there was a group of people that were real vocal. And then there was a peripheral group outside of that group that read it all and talked about it amongst their buddies, but didn't really chime into the conversation. And really that second tier group, that peripheral group that was reading all this web chatter, I mean, the honest truth is they're really the ones that kind of led the appetite here and took it where it is, because real shortly here, you know, in this story, R&T came out with the Mondo, and probably nothing has helped me sell as many duck calls as the Mondo, because when R&T came out with the Mondo, they took that son of a gun nationwide, and it was like one of their best sellers 2 or 3 years after they, I don't think it was the very first year or the second year, but, you know, somewhere along in the 2012, 2013, 2014 range, I mean, it was their single best seller of the whole year. And so, I mean, that right there tells you what kind of a national appetite there was for cutdowns. I mean, if Rich and Tone, you know, I mean, but Rich and Tone and Echo are the vanilla ice cream, you know, I mean, they're the apple pie of duck calls. I mean, they're both great companies, but I mean, they're Chevrolet and Ford, right? It's everybody else is competing. I mean, they own the market in terms of Arkansas J frames. And so if you got a company that has for nearly 40 years at that point, or 30 plus years at that point, made a living for a whole town of people on J frame duck calls, and now they got a new bottle that's a cut down and that's their best seller. I mean, good gracious. They become the breaking plow, and then you have all these people that are looking at it and going, this is a novelty item. And so they look at it, and what happens is they go, dang, you know, $140, I get a Mondo. And they're like, but I don't know if I can blow a Mondo. So what do? They go buy a package clamshell $50 cut down, and they blow it, and some of them love it and keep it forever. Some of them blow it and are like, yeah, I can do this. I can figure it out. And they go buy a Mondo. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I like losing a customer to a Mondo, but for a long stretch of years, probably 5 or 6 years of the 10 that I've been in business, I can promise you that that's the consumer behavior. They buy a poly molded cut down because it's kind of like a gateway drug. You know, they're sticking their toe in the water a little bit. And then they buy something that has a perceived higher value in terms of an acrylic duck call. That's why the Brute's been so successful this fall and this winter. I mean, it's a great sounding duck call, but at the end of the day, what people want is they want a cut down, and they want a high quality product in acrylic. And the American duck hunter has decided that acrylic is a superior material to polycarbonate. And in a lot of ways it is, but, Anyways, that's a ridiculously long answer to your question about how did we kind of keep the momentum going. And so I just want to go on record and say, I don't really think that I deserve any credit for keeping the momentum going into the secondary tier. I really think that if anybody deserves the credit for that, it's Richentone. I mean, when they came with the Mondo, it just made my life. People were like, oh gosh, how are you going to build a Cillian McCall? I was like, are you kidding me? This is the best thing that's ever happened for me. These people are making – they legitimized what I've been saying, which was that air bottle blow a cut down, you know? Like,
right.
One of the top companies in the industry just came out and said, yep, he's right. I mean, that's the way I looked at it.
Well, next week we're going to talk about perfecting the quarter pounder, I guess you'd say. I look forward to that.
Hold the onions.
Hey, you know who can't sleep tonight? You know who's like a kid at Christmas?
There's a lot of those tonight. I can tell you Josh Criswell watched the interstate bird fly. He watched that interstate bird fly up to roost, and he sent it to our group text a couple hours ago, and I said, Josh, I'll be honest with you. You need to just slide on in there about 3:30 tomorrow morning and just wait for him to gobble the first time. And he said, I said, I believe I'd put it in his rear end somewhere between the first gobble and the second gobble. And just put, just go ahead and put that one to bed.
Man.
He said, part of me really wants to, but he said, I don't think I can bring myself to close that chapter this away. I said, well, okay, whatever you want to do. But
Criswell's been on my mind ever since we started talking about turkeys.
Who are you thinking about?
Well, that's who I was thinking about. I mean, he is this is his bread and butter, man. This is his time of the year. And I'll tell you this, I didn't really, really get fired up until I walked outside, I guess it was yesterday morning, and there was a red bird. You know, the red bird starts singing this time of the year. It's, you know, the mating, they mate the same time a turkey does. That bird you always hear this time of year is usually a red bird. It's time. Yep. And it just, I look forward to it. But Spence, I enjoyed it. Good. Can't wait till next week.
Yeah, man.
That should be a great part of the story. But thank you again for being here. Good luck in the morning. I want to thank all of you that listened to this edition of the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.